Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who explains why the Bush administration's U.N. ambassador and a nominee for a high State Department post could undercut the White House battle against terrorism. Melanie Griffin of the Sierra Club, who discusses the post-September 11th push to authorize oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and Thea Lee, chief international economist with the AFL-CIO, who describes a campaign to defeat fast-track trade legislation in Congress, where Republican lawmakers have linked the bill with the fight against terrorism. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a daring daytime attack on October the 1st, 38 people were killed in a car bombing in the disputed territory of Kashmir, where the Indian Army, pro-Pakistan militants and the Mujahideen fighters are at odds in a deadly civil war. According to media reports, Islamic militants hijacked an Indian government vehicle and then loaded it with a bomb that later exploded near the entrance of the Legislative Assembly building in Srinagar, Kashmir's summer capital. For over 50 years, India has ruled the southern half of Kashmir, a mostly Muslim region of 9.5 million people. Pakistan has governed the northern half of Kashmir, and the conflict between the two countries has been the flashpoint for several wars. The level of anti-Indian violence exploded in 1989, when pro-Muslim forces sought full independence. Through the last 12 years, over 35,000 people have been killed in the region, now considered by many experts to be the most dangerous in the world. According to the news magazine In These Times, rival factions blame each other for the growing level of bloodshed. The Indian Army blames the Islamic militants. Human rights groups blame the Indian Army. Meanwhile, the Mujahideen, who are waging a holy war in Kashmir, blame the so-called renegades, Muslim former activists who are now spying for the Indian Army. As the US-led assault on Afghanistan intensifies, the level of violence in Kashmir is getting worse. On the eve of a visit by US Secretary of State Colin Powell, Indian troops shelled Pakistani bases in Pakistan-controlled areas of northern Kashmir. Several militant groups organized a massive general strike to protest Powell's visit. Now, the Indian Army threatens to punish Pakistan for any future terrorist attacks. On the fateful morning of September the 11th, Asian American writer William Wong flew out of a New York airport in the final leg of his trip back from Durban, South Africa, where he'd been attending the United Nations World Conference Against Racism. 90 minutes into his morning flight to San Francisco, Wong's plane was grounded in Indianapolis, where he learned about the terror attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that killed 6,000 people. Like most people across the globe, Wong was sickened by the attacks. But soon afterwards, he started to see some connections between the terror attacks and the recently concluded UN racism conference that was marred when the United States and Israel walked out due to proposed language condemning Israel's treatment of Palestinians, going as far as to compare it to genocide. According to the news magazine In These Times, many American activists came away from the UN racism conference with mixed feelings. There was pride in the fact that the final declaration labelled the transatlantic slave trade a crime against humanity and said that economic reparations for victims of the slave trade and colonialism were worth considering. Although some American activists grew frustrated with conference chair Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, for rejecting many NGO proposals, others believe the conference and the thousands of activists it attracted could help shape a new international movement. The Nation magazine reports that Philadelphia prosecutors have struck out in their attempt to press criminal charges against activists who protested at the year 2000 Republican National Convention. During the Republican Convention, more than 400 activists were arrested by the Philadelphia police. Some were held in jail for up to 2 weeks, and several organizers faced exorbitant bail from hundreds of thousands to $1 million. So far, nearly all the criminal cases brought against the protesters have ended with not guilty verdicts or with judges throwing out the charges during pre-trial hearings. One judge threw out charges against Terence McGuckin, accused by police of leading a group of protesters in blocking a traffic intersection and so held on $500,000 bail. The case fell apart when the defense presented a videotape showing McGuckin nearly a mile away from the intersection. During the protests, Kate Sorensen was put in solitary confinement for 10 days, on charges that she directed protesters to vandalise a police car, flip over dumpsters and set the trash on fire. Only later did the arresting police detective admit that he did not see Sorensen commit any of the offences. The felony charges were dropped. Now the protesters have filed civil lawsuits against the city of Philadelphia for violations of due process and for rights violations. As Chris Hermes of the R2K Legal Collective, who defended the protesters, commented, "The city of Philadelphia prided itself on not using tear gas or rubber bullets. But it did everything else, and it did it with such vehemence that hundreds of people experienced serious violations and abuse." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
As the Bush administration continues to bomb targets inside Afghanistan in the fight against terrorism, some embarrassing questions are being asked about John Negroponte, the newly appointed U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Negroponte, who was confirmed by the Senate shortly after the September 11th terror attacks, had been the U.S. ambassador in Honduras during the time of the dirty wars in Central America in the 1980s. Critics accuse Negroponte of complicity with the terrorist activities of Contra guerrillas fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government and death squads operating within the Honduran military. With this history, some observers charge that Negroponte lacks the moral authority to represent America as our country rallies the world to fight terrorism. The White House also hopes to win confirmation for Otto Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Reich, a Cuban-American, is a controversial figure for his role in the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra scandal. Reich is also accused of helping anti-Castro Cuban Orlando Bosch to come to the U.S. Bosch had been imprisoned in Venezuela for 11 years for his part in the 1976 bombing of a Cuban civilian airliner that killed 73 people. After arriving in the U.S., Bosch received a presidential pardon from George Bush Sr. Larry Burns is with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs based in Washington, D.C. He spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the Bush administration's choice of Negroponte and Reich for high government posts and how this may affect U.S. credibility in the fight against terrorism.
Otto Reich is a man who much more deserves to be in jail than to be sitting in the State Department. He's a person during his stay at the Office of Public Diplomacy utilized that office as a propaganda center for a kind of unlimited acts of skullduggery to advance the Contra cause and to bypass congressional opposition to funding the Contras. During this period, although he was operating over the protests of Secretary of State Shultz in the State Department, he in fact was operational through the National Security Council, specifically Oliver North's office. The two principals of this organization, a man named Spitz Channel and Richard Miller, both pleaded guilty to fraud at a later point. Although Otto Reich was never formally indicted by Congress, most of the people he associated with were, and he certainly was indictable if the Department of Justice was mindful of doing so at the time.
What about his connection to Miami's Orlando Bosch, who was at the time being held in a Venezuelan jail for 11 years on charges of masterminding the October 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner that killed all 73 people on board, including the Cuban Olympic fencing team as well? What is Otto Reich's connection to Orlando Bosch?
Well, of course, Otto Reich was ambassador at the time in Venezuela and wrote a very supportive letter for Bosch that would facilitate his return to the United States and so forth. Since then, Bosch, of course, has become something of a local hero in Miami, and Otto Reich has benefited from this because it was Congressman Diaz-Balart, the arch-right-wing congressman from Dade, Miami, who went to a close aide of Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, and said to that aide that this is an appointment right to the State Department, to the post that George Bush Jr. has appointed him, told Bush's operative that we'll be very grateful for this, and of course we'll remember it on Election Day. Now, it's difficult to have respect for Secretary of State Colin Powell that he accepted the nomination of this man if he knew about this man's relationship, very testy relationship, with former Secretary of State Shultz. And this nomination coming together with the nomination of several rather tawdry figures like John Negroponte to be ambassador to the United Nations.
Well, he was very conveniently slipped through, I think, right after the September 11th terror attack
in
New York.
Yes, that certainly worked for him.
I don't even know if there were any hearings. In one day, he was almost unanimously voted in. What is your opinion, Larry Burns, about his appointment and the credibility of the United States in regards to its claim of fighting terrorism throughout the world?
Well, of course, Frank DeLomo, the editorial writer of the Los Angeles Times, wrote a brilliant editorial condemning the confirmation of Negroponte, saying that everyone in the United Nations will laugh every time that Negroponte stands up and starts speaking about terrorism when he was a master of terrorism. He also was a master of forgetting anything that would compromise his position, that he knew nothing of the death squads that taking place in Honduras at the time.
Getting back to Otto Reich, journalist Robert Perry in Fooling America 1992 says that Otto Reich made a trip to CBS's Washington office to pressure one of its correspondents and bureau chief to stop their critical coverage of Reagan's Nicaraguan policies.
For example, there was a distinguished wire service reporter who attended a press conference called by Negroponte in Honduras in the early 80s. And Otto Reich was present. Negroponte said to the audience that, you know, the administration was very anxious that U.S. policy in Nicaragua would be reported fairly. And the wire service reporter said, well, we don't understand what the problem is. You know, the problem is we're not getting information from you. That's the problem. So what do you think is the problem? Meanwhile, Otto Reich had moved over to the couch where this wire service reporter was sitting. He sat down next to him and whispered in his ear. He said, the problem is communists like you. And that's Otto Reich.
That was Larry Burns, executive director with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact COHA by calling area code 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. Since September 11th, American media coverage has focused almost exclusively on the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington and on the subsequent U.S. airstrikes against Afghanistan and the search for Osama bin Laden. One of the important stories to fall by the wayside was the attempt by the Bush administration and many in Congress to authorize oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. That is, until Bush himself raised the issue last week in calling for the passage of his energy bill as a national security measure. The administration's proposal calls for increased oil and gas drilling and coal mining to make the U.S. less dependent on foreign energy sources. Meanwhile, the average fuel economy for 2002 model cars was lower than for last year's models. Paradoxically, the White House has opposed raising these standards. In August, the House voted in favor of opening up the Arctic Refuge to drilling, which is estimated to hold just 6 months' national supply of economically recoverable oil. Some opponents of the legislation in the Senate have vowed a filibuster, if necessary, to prevent drilling there. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Melanie Griffin, director of land protection programs with the Sierra Club, about where the legislation now stands and alternative policies that could help wean America from oil and other non-renewable energy sources.
As far as we've seen, all of the strongest proponents of protecting the refuge remain strong proponents and have said that they still intend to stop any energy bill that includes Arctic refuge drilling. The oil industry allies in the Senate have been trying to attach Arctic drilling to anything and everything that goes by. They actually tried to stop the military preparedness bill by attaching Arctic drilling, and that was driven back. And then they tried to stop the airline safety bill by attaching Arctic drilling, and that was turned back as well. So they are trying any efforts they can to get this through the Congress. There have been ongoing efforts to look at energy policy in a more reasonable time frame with sort of more sensible, thoughtful debate and discussion, and those are ongoing. I think it's probably not likely that we'll see a bill this year because Majority Leader Daschle has said that he wants energy legislation to move in a more reasonable way and not in a sort of a crisis atmosphere. So they are meeting currently and talking about what might be in an energy bill. Of course, they want to address national security issues, things like the safety of our energy infrastructure, and do that sooner rather than later. But as far as the longer-term energy bill, I think we likely won't see that until next year.
Do you think that the administration and Republicans in Congress are exploiting the tragedy of September 11th to push their energy policy through, to try to push it through more quickly?
I think that there are some in Congress who, unfortunately, are taking advantage of the situation. It's really unfortunate, and we have just been reiterating that we think this is a time for healing and unity, and we ought to be focusing on issues that unite us and on protecting the safety of all Americans and not on the issues that divide us. But unfortunately, there are a few people in Congress who have been pushing this industry-backed agenda and just don't seem to understand how inappropriate that is at this time.
Would you call this, or would the Sierra Club call this, the biggest environmental issue, or the biggest, at least the biggest energy issue facing America right now, the issue of what to do about Anwar?
I think that the Arctic refuge issue represents a very big choice. And so in that sense, yes. Now, obviously, there's some huge issues to be dealt with, nuclear power, safety, electricity generation, renewables. But the bottom line is we have got to get off oil, not just foreign oil, oil. We only sit on less than 3% of the world's oil. So we are never going to be energy independent if we depend on oil. So we need to rely less on oil, not more on oil. And that's why we think any sensible energy bill has to move towards efficiency and renewables with transition in natural gas and get away from oil, not opening up our last wilderness areas to oil drilling instead of going in a new direction. That is the past. We need to move forward, and we ought to not leave nothing but devastation in our wake.
What does the Sierra Club say about what it would take to not need ever to go into Anwar, because we could save more oil in you know some period of time by just making cars more efficient?
Yeah, I mean, if we increased our miles per gallon to just 40 miles per gallon, we could save all the oil that we import from the Middle East in a year, and certainly more than we would might be able to get from the Arctic refuge. One of the things that has been coming up a lot is oil drilling advocates say that they can drill in an environmentally sensitive manner that will only affect 2,000 acres. And that has been making some headway in the argument, but people need to actually understand that the 2,000 acres is not just a little confined 2,000-acre area. It would be spread all across the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, which is the biological heart of the refuge that's of concern here. It would be just like a web of roads and airstrips and gravel pits and oil wells. It wouldn't just be a little square, which is the way the oil industry is trying to portray it. So you wouldn't just stick down a pipe and be done.
That was Melanie Griffin of the Sierra Club. For more information, call the Sierra Club at area code 202-547-1144 or visit their website at www.sierraclub.org.
Before the September 11th terror attacks, the Bush administration's drive to pass a trade promotion authority bill was in trouble. The legislation, formerly known as Fast Track, would grant the president authority to negotiate future international trade deals with minimal debate in Congress and no chance for legislators to propose corrective amendments. But in the days following the assaults on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the Bush administration's trade representative renewed the fight on Fast Track by tying support for free trade with the fight against terrorism. Labor leaders, including AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Richard Trumka, condemned the attempt to link passage of Fast Track to patriotism. Fast Track was defeated by a progressive coalition led by the AFL-CIO when President Clinton tried to win congressional approval in 1997. Then, as now, a broad coalition of groups, including family farmers, environmentalists, and human rights activists, have joined with labor to oppose Fast Track. If approved, the Fast Track process would enable the White House to expedite approval of the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, or FTAA. FTAA, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been criticized for the lack of labor or environmental standards and the power it surrenders to corporations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Thea Lee, chief international economist with the AFL-CIO, who discusses the campaign to defeat fast-track trade legislation now being considered in the House of Representatives.
Well, the grant of fast-track or trade negotiating authority is something Congress needs to give to the president, because under our Constitution, Congress actually has the right to make trade policy. But for the last couple of decades, Congress has passed that over to the president along with a set of negotiating objectives. And the trade debate has really heated up over the last decade in the United States, and trade policy is more controversial than it's ever been, and so this grant of trade negotiating authority has become very problematic and very difficult, with Congress being unwilling to give over to the president the ability to bring back a trade agreement for an up or down vote when so many important domestic policies might be affected by that. So this vote is very important. I think Congress sees it that way, and the president does too.
Now, the House Republican leadership brought Fast Track back into the thick of things right after the September 11th terror attacks. And in that, I've heard it described that they wrapped the legislation in the flag, basically saying that Fast Track was a part of the fight against terrorism and a patriotic duty. Can you describe some of your reaction and the reaction of those folks at the AFL-CIO to this strategy on the part of proponents of Fast Track?
Well, it's just unconscionable that the U.S. Trade Representative or Congressman Bill Thomas, who's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, would somehow try to take advantage of the national tragedy in order to ram through a very divisive trade bill that's going to have a big impact on working people, both in this country and around the world, for many, many years to come. They didn't have the votes to pass Fast Track before September 11th, and the idea that they would use this tragedy and use the so-called fight against terrorism or the need for economic stimulus to try to push a fast-track bill through at this point, I think is actually maddening to a lot of Democrats and some Republicans as well, and it may actually backfire on them, because what we're seeing in the House of Representatives, Democrats are so insulted by this tactic that they are not jumping on board with the fast-track fight. And so we're hoping that it will ultimately backfire and will end without the ability to move forward.
Is there any truth at all that this fast-track negotiating authority is in any way an element in the fight against terrorism? I mean, how do they justify that statement?
Well, it's absurd. And in fact, I think the opposite is true. To the extent that fast-track will facilitate more trade agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, will extend that to the entire hemisphere and will facilitate again or make easier a new round of negotiations with the World Trade Organization. These are policies that have actually been very bad for developing countries, certainly bad for working people or poor people in developing countries. And so we're not likely to gain a lot of supporters around the world in the fight against terrorism simply by ramming through more flawed trade policies that have the same problems as the past. And in terms of the other argument they've made, which is that somehow fast track is necessary to get the world economy going again, this is a ridiculous argument, absurd when you look at the United States. Here we are, we've been in a manufacturing recession for over a year now. We've lost about over a million manufacturing jobs just in the last 14 months. the idea that what the U.S. economy needs right now is fast-track authority so we can have more NAFTAs and more negotiations at the WTO and let our trade deficits, the excess of imports over exports, go through the roof with even more countries, I think is just ridiculous.
Thea Lee, I wondered if you'd comment on some of the environmental and labor rights provisions in this latest Republican-sponsored bill. Does this do anything to allay the fears of many in the labor movement and the global justice movement that this fast-tracked authority would sell out workers in the environment?
No, the bill that's under consideration now is H.R. 3005. It's the bill introduced by Congressman Thomas, a Republican from California. And even though this bill is being sold as some sort of bipartisan compromise on labor and environment, the truth is it's not bipartisan and it's not a compromise. There are a tiny handful of Democrats who were roped in to work with Representative Thomas on this, and they were not a representative group, and they were certainly not leaders in the Congress. And in terms of the content of the bill, this bill is very little different from all the fast-track bills we've had in the past. It has more words about labor and environment than we've had in the past, but the outcome, the actual results are going to be no different. All this is, in the Thomas bill, is a negotiating objective. That is, all we're doing is asking our negotiators to go and ask for some very moderate and weak labor provisions, but there's nothing in the bill that would require the negotiators actually to succeed.
That was Thea Lee, chief international economist with the AFL-CIO. Contact the Labor Federation by calling area code 202-637-5000 or visit their website at www.aflcio.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website, www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Belinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.